Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Since 9/11 of 2001, a lot of people, journalists, politicians, scholars, have argued that the attacks of 9/11 were just the latest battle in a very long conflict between the West and the Islamic world, a conflict rooted in the core values of the two sides, values that some people argue that cannot be reconciled. Our guest for this hour, historian David Levering Lewis, takes a rather different view, or at least he says that this business of conflict between the two sides is much more complicated than sometimes we make it seem. And in fact, he says that these two worlds have not always been at odds. They have been, certainly from time to time, but not always. And in fact, he says, if you take a look at that 600 years that Muslims controlled large parts of the European continent, Islamic culture had a profound and, I think he would argue, a positive effect on Europe. This morning we'll be talking with David Levering Lewis about his recent book, God's Crucible, Islam and the Making of Europe. And it looks primarily at that period in the Middle Ages when Muslims ruled Spain. And I have some interesting questions about that, about relations at this time between the Islamic world and what would become Europe, and why it is that the Muslims advanced into Spain, and what might have happened if they had not been stopped at what is now, roughly speaking, the border between Spain and France. The book is out recently. It's published by W.W. Norton, has gotten a lot of attention, perhaps caused a little bit of controversy, and we're pleased to have our guest here to talk about it in this hour of focus. David Levering Lewis is a university professor at New York University. He is the author of a two-volume biography of W.E.B. Du Bois. Both volumes received the Pulitzer Prize. He is the author and editor of eight other books, and he's joining us this morning by phone. As we talk, questions, comments from listeners are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people is just that they try to keep their comments, questions brief, so we can get as many callers in as possible. But certainly, people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation. That always makes things a lot more interesting. 333-9455 is the number to use if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. We do also have that toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. We'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 or WILL, and toll free 800-222-9455. Professor Lewis, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
I hope so too. We'll try not to make it too rough a ride. I'm interested just to start in how it is you think about this, the clash of civilizations kind of analysis that we have seen so much of since 9/11, and whether you felt that one of the things that you wanted to try to do with this book, it may not have been very clear that you started with that kind of idea, but whether it came to be that you were interested in trying to get people to look at this a little bit differently, approach it from a different sort of angle.
Yes, yes. In fact, your lead-in really captured one of the major premises of the book, and that was that without again saying the fact that Islam and Christianity, or the East and the West, as sometimes it's characterized as being, have been in tension and conflict. Yet there have been long periods when that was not the case, and when the relationship between the two was really quite productive and beneficial. The problem with the clash of civilizations mantra is that it really becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If, in fact, the core values of civilizations are incompatible, then, of course, the logic is one of conflict, one of adversity. If we go back in time, though, as I do in God's Crucible, to the moment of contact between Islam and what becomes Europe in the 8th century, we see unfolding a rather different, much more complex, much more nuanced, and much more interactive history.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps you might talk a little bit about these two worlds as they were on the eve of the conquest of what is now Spain by the Muslim Circes, the year 711 we're talking about. And you do indeed devote a good amount of time to, in the initial parts of the book, to talk a little bit about the beginnings of Islam and how it is it spread from what is now Saudi Arabia throughout North Africa and comes to the point where the Muslims, in a manner of speaking, are standing there on the shore of Mediterranean looking across at Spain, which is not that far.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you might talk just a little bit about what the Islamic world at that point looked like.
At that point, it really is charged up and dynamic, a remarkable phenomenon, because in a very short period of time, from, say, 632, the death of the Prophet Muhammad, to 711, when Tariq ibn Ziyad leads his Berbers across what become the Straits of Gibraltar, named after him indeed, the Arabs have, with Berbers and Persians, produced or by incorporating what they conquered, have produced a blend of society that is extremely advanced technologically, commercially, scientifically, militarily, to be sure. Already, the expanse of real estate incorporated by the Muslim Empire or the Dar al Islam stretches to almost to China, to India, and of course along the North African littoral, incorporating the Maghreb, and indeed below the Sub-Sahara. So this is an empire in terms of real estate that matches Alexander the Great's or the recently collapsed and collapsing Roman Empire. And so when it brings to the Iberian Peninsula development that in that brilliant century has characterized it, it arrives on the European continent facing the detritus of the Roman Empire, one in which the German tribes, desperately trying to bring order to the real estate that that they inherit, are by comparison considerably less developed culturally, politically, economically, commercially, but perhaps not militarily.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, I think, you make the point that at this point in the 8th century, that the idea that we have today, the idea of Europe, and the fact that some of these people, obviously today, they're truly, they think of themselves as French, as German, as Belgian, as Italian, as whatever. But there is this notion of Europe and of Europeans at the time that we're talking about. That didn't exist. And in fact, I think you make this interesting argument that says that perhaps the military and to some sense political cultural conflict between these two worlds helped to form the very idea of European identity.
That's absolutely true. The term Europe described a continent that is Arab, or a land of darkness. That was the Semitic meaning of the term, but it had no anthropological significance until about a century after the initial meeting of Muslims and Christians at the base of the Pyrenees in about 732. A battle takes place. In European historiography, it becomes one of the set pieces of all time, in which supposedly, arguably, Charles Martel, the leader of the Franks, stops the advance of the jihad beyond the Pyrenees. And writing about that great military and geopolitical moment, a Spanish scribe described it as the victory of the Europenses. And that term, Europenses, then will come to describe in a kind of meta way this collection of disparate Germans, Goths, Visigoths, Franks, Lombards, and others as a collectivity, a European society. So one is indebted to a military campaign for the development of a concept that, in the passage of time, with passage of time, becomes, of course, extraordinarily significant and defining. Mm-hmm.
Our guest in this first hour of Focus 580, David Levering Lewis. He is university professor at New York University. We're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, God's Crucible. The subtitle is Islam and the Making of Europe, 570 to 1215. Basically, as we have explained, concentrating on this period of several hundred years when Muslims ruled in what is now Spain. Yeah, the book is published by Norton. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that one would want to be cautious on the way that one talks about Spain at this time, Al-Andalus, what they called it. I think that maybe some of the reviewers have suggested that you're overly praiseful. At the same time, I guess if you think about what life must have been like in the rest of Europe at that time, if you had your choice, I'd say probably that's where you would rather have lived. What sort of a place was it, Spain, at this time under Muslim rule?
Spain, the Iberia that the Muslims occupied had been run for about two centuries by Visigoths. They were really not a particularly apt people when it came to statecraft and to commercial development. Slavery was the basis for the economy. And for many, many years, there was a divide between rulers and subject population along lines of race and religion. Catholicism, or the Christianity, I should say, that the Visigoths practiced was quite different from that of the majority of its of the people. One would call it Catholicism, and theirs was Arianism, a big debate about the nature of the Trinity. Conversion took place, finally, on the part of the Visigoths in the 7th century, and it resulted in the persecution of the significant Jewish population of Iberia. That was because the Visigoths believed that in order to have a strong monarchy, there must not be any religious differentiation in the population. I go into that simply because it explains why the Arabs arriving with about 7,000 men were able in 2 years' time to subjugate Iberia. It was because of the divisions within the Visigoth state. It imploded quite rapidly, and the role of the Sephardic or Jewish population in that implosion was critical. In their collaboration with the invading Muslims was absolutely strategic to the success of the invasion, and so that set indeed a kind of pas de deux or collaboration between Jews and Muslims, which would endure for many many centuries. Over the Pyrenees, we have really a very, very undeveloped and primitive economic and political arrangement, contests between various Germanic tribes. Those go on for a time until the emergence of one group, the Franks, brings a certain degree of unity and stability. However, in terms of the survival of the things that Rome is so famous for, its statecraft, its laws, its commercial vitality, its organization, those things are a faint memory as these Germans struggle along in the remains of the Roman Empire to create various polities.
There's one man clearly here that you admire, and if you say that there are heroes in this story, this would have to be one of them. And this would be one of the governors of Iberia. And apparently there were, in the early years, there were a number of them, but they didn't last very long. This man was an exception, Abdulrahman I. Tell us about him.
Well, people who stitch together the Muslim empire were called the Umayyads. That is to say, the guys running the show from Damascus represented a continuity, family-centered and rather pragmatic. They were overthrown in 750, however, by another group of Muslims called the Abbasids. The overthrow came because after time all power corrupts, and finally the rulers were deemed quite corrupt. And their displacement led to the relocation of the center of the Muslim empire from Damascus to Baghdad. But there survived one cluster of Umayyads led by a remarkable prince named Abdulrahman, who ends up crossing the Gibraltar Straits, showing up, and in a very short time rallying a sufficient number of forces to establish or reestablish the Umayyad power in Iberia. In no time at all, he has brought a high degree of order to what had become a rather divisive situation, and he has been able to make possible the beginnings of a quite robust agricultural development and commercial development. Indeed, it's during his period of time that the various crops that we think of as native to Iberia make their appearance. The olive, which had always been there, is developed to a great degree. The orange blossoms that today waft Alhambra are a product of his agronomic policies, and the vast irrigation project that became distinguishing for Iberia. The Romans had, of course, begun it. That project moves apace. And so by the end of his reign in 778, Iberia really has become a powerhouse of agricultural robustness and commercial activity and political stability.
Mm-hmm. And something here, and I think we've touched on it, but I think it's important to make the point again, and something that I think is very important to you, is this idea that at the time that we're talking about here, that Muslims and Jews and Christians all manage to live together, maybe not in perfect harmony, but at a very high level of harmony, and that Jews and Christians were not forced to convert to Islam, although perhaps there were incentives to do so, and that it was a time of cultural flowering because there was this atmosphere of living together in tolerance, and that perhaps it I know some people might say you shouldn't use a modern term in this kind of context, but one, I suppose the term that comes to mind is multicultural, that this was, for its time, a very multicultural society.
One does kind of squinch one's nose a bit when we use terms of the currency of today to describe the remote past. And let's be guarded and say that although there was collaboration and kind of codependency even between the various groups, the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews, it was a very hierarchical arrangement. Make no mistake about it, the Arabs were on top, and there were sumptuary laws, there were laws of conduct which, if violated, could be severely sanctioned. But in time, it is true that this society became relatively tolerant and collaborative. For pragmatic reasons, indeed, the demographics of Iberia encouraged that. The numbers of Arabs within the population in the first century, of course, were necessarily small. So to maintain their hegemony, they needed to be mindful of how far they might go in terms of abuse and the rigor of their dominion. But then, in the next century, as you suggest, conversion of the original population moves apace so that the percentage of Christians who have embraced Islam reaches about 40% of the original population. That, of course, transforms this from a situation in which a small group ruled over a large group to a large group embracing the values, the language, the religion of its original conquerors. And it then produces a collaborative mix that becomes the cradle for a technological and cultural and literary flowering without which one could really not envision the European development centuries later over the Pyrenees that we call the Renaissance.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we'll take a call here and invite others. Our guest is David Levering Lewis. He's an historian. He is a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his two-volume biography of W.E.B. Du Bois. And in fact, he's the first person ever to win two Pulitzer Prizes for a back-to-back volumes of a biography. He is a university professor at New York University, and in addition to the Du Bois books, is the author or editor of eight others. His new book is titled God's Crucible, Islam and the Making of Europe, 570 to 1215. It is published by W.W. Norton. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have someone here where we are in Champaign County. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a couple of concerns, pretty diverse. One of them is you were saying that the Sephardi Jewry in Spain, at least the powerful ones, I suppose, were seen as collaborating with the invasion, as it were. I'd already been thinking about, when I heard the topic of your discussion, about the where the antecedents of European race anti-Semitism comes from, in the sense that the Crusades, the series of Crusades that Europe had against the Middle East, included pogroms against, you know, sort of the enemy at home, as it were, the other. And I was just thinking of that as being just sort of a typical displacement, scapegoating. But, and I don't, nothing should justify those, but I'm wondering what you can say about the relationship there. I mean, obviously, Northern German, our Northern European Jewry were Ashkenazi and were not Sephardi and didn't necessarily share much culturally and certainly politically with the Sephardis.
Right.
So
yes.
And you're saying there wasn't even a real concept of Europe, so how could there have been much of a concept of totality?
That's a good point, and one wants to be cautious about a phenomenon that develops at one point, being the really energizing element in a similar phenomenon much later, and yet I think that your speculation is fruitful. Visigothic anti-Semitism was unique. It was virulent. The first final solution is developed by a Visigothic royal named Sisebut, who, after any number of edicts coming out of council, the various Toledo councils, Council Toledo 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and in each of those councils, after the conversion of the Visigoth to Catholicism from Arianism, edicts were promulgated giving the Jewish population but so much time to embrace the true faith or move on. In fact, in reality, those edicts were never enforced for various reasons, humanity, the fact that this was an indispensable population in many parts of Iberia, other reasons. However, by the end of the 7th century, by the end of the 7th century, determination of the Visigoths to implement the forced conversion of the Jews was really quite intense, and the consequences were the outmigration of the population into Aquitaine and Gaul to North Africa, and indeed the forced conversion of large numbers of people. That had a role in intelligence that was communicated to the advancing jihad along the littoral. Jewish populations in Egypt, for example, quite well knew of the weaknesses and difficulties that the Visigoths were having, so that when the invasion took place, collaboration is a tainted word for quite modern reasons, but cooperation of Jews and Arabs was a distinguishing aspect of the occupation. Far, far later, as the Reconquista gins up, that is, the Christian kinglets of the Iberian North begin to descend south and to reoccupy or reconquer Iberia, the Visigothic example and the collaboration and the multiculturalism and all the things that we think were really rather positive about this experience are viewed as negatives. And the role of the Sephardic community in its congenial interaction with the Muslim community, it becomes a reproach, and certainly is an element in Spanish anti-Semitism, which was, of course, quite virulent.
I don't know whether you can comment on this, and there's a lot in what you just said to dwell on, but on the other end of the Maghreb, I'm wondering if you know anything about the sort of the impasse or detente that happened with the Ethiopian kingdom and the Muslim expansion, because in that situation, there has been Muslim conversion through that region, but there was sort of never, you know, the sword taking the faith forward, and it may have just been tactical, but it seems to me that why a similar sort of thing didn't happen there.
I'm sorry. Why in Ethiopia?
Why the Muslim encroachment didn't happen in Ethiopia the same way it spread through the whole Maghreb?
Well, in part, it has to do with the direction and the priorities of the Ummah or of the Dar al Arb, the House of War. For the first two centuries, the concern is really Europe is a sidebar. The Iberian Peninsula was regarded from Damascus as a diversion. Sultan Suleiman, not Suleiman the Magnificent, but the Umayyad Sultan Suleiman, believed that the West, as they called Iberia, the West was a distraction, because what they wanted to do was to crack the impregnable metropolis of Constantinople. And Anatolia became the focus of military expansion, and beyond Anatolia and beyond the Oxus River, the expansion towards China, which they reach in 749. Indeed, it's at a battle in 749, 750, the Tang, at the Tang that the Arabs discover paper, which will have, of course, all sorts of importance in cultural terms. And then in the Indus, the expansion there, where Buddhism and Islam meet with certain tensions. And so the Sub-Sahara is, until 1050, not terribly geopolitically important to it. The other point would be that the accessibility of Abyssinia presents a problem. It's like trying to conquer Switzerland. It's mountainous, and the terrain is forbidding. And then finally, the Ethiopians gave a very good account of themselves whenever they needed to defend themselves, so that Ethiopia does not, until much later, present a target of a compelling opportunity. And I suppose the Arabs remembered that just before the development of Islam, the Abyssinians or the Ethiopians had occupied much of today's Yemen. Indeed, the birth of Muhammad as dated 570, that may be accurate, but it had a mythical justification in that was the very date in which the Ethiopians advanced upon Mecca, threatening it, and miraculously they were turned back. The relationship between Arabs and Ethiopians, there was a good reason for mutual respect. There were the other factors, of course, of priorities and a difficulty in simply conquering the kingdom.
We have less than 15 minutes left in this part of the show. I have some other callers. Hope the caller will forgive me and get on here to someone next. And this is Bloomington, Indiana, line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. You know, granted, Muslims have achieved high culture. They certainly have. But they also have a consistent history of religious conversion by military conquest. We see their unremitting hostility toward a little nation of Jews, little tiny nation of Jews among a continent of Muslims, they absolutely unremitting hostility. We have seen in Iraq how they even commit mass murder against opposing Muslim sects, Sunnis against Shias, and vice versa. In history, they militarily conquered Constantinople. Constantinople became Istanbul. Then they almost militarily conquered Europe. They got to the gates of Vienna. Do you remember the date they were finally defeated at Vienna? What date was that?
That was in 1683, yeah. Was it, I believe.
9/11, 1683, right?
I'm sorry, 9/11.
9/11, 1683, they were defeated.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yes. Well, that is true. And
yeah.
From that point on, to follow your excursion through history, it becomes asymmetrical to the advantage of Europe, and Europe advances. And many of the things that you have characterized as negative elements in the history of Islam could be also ascribed to Europe as it advances imperialistically into the Fertile Crescent. But the point I don't want to argue about the current situation in the Middle East, except to say that it is curious that if in the 8th century Arabs and Jews achieved a quite remarkable collaboration, which is ongoing for centuries, what does one make of the fact that of the absence of that in today's world? As for the conquest of subject populations, with rare exception, forced conversion was until recent date unknown in the Islamic experience. The Quran, Surah, which says that of religion there is no compulsion, was obediently observed. You had a choice of conversion. You had a choice of not converting and paying the tax. You had a choice of opposing and with the consequences of the battlefield. So it's useful to look back at the ways in which Arabs and Christians, East and West, have interrelated before one makes draconian judgments about the present-day situation. It may well be that the founding of the State of Israel, a necessary, defensible, and admirable achievement after World War II, has more to do with the geopolitics of that situation than the Quran, the history of Islam, or other elements of this fraught narrative.
Yeah. We have some other callers here, and I want to try to give the chance. But just the we're here back to the clash of cultures again, and it seems that whenever we get into these conversations, there will be people who are partisans on one of the other sides of the confrontation, who will haul out their list of complaints, including forced conversion, including the tendency to kill viciously your opponents, condoning slavery, and a long list of things. The thing is, it seems like no matter which side you're on, you can use the same list.
Yeah. It's an inventory that is the monopoly of nobody.
And so that gets to this question. Is it really possible to have a reasoned, fair, dispassionate kind of even-handed assessment of both of these cultural streams, their contributions, and also their shortcomings?
Well, that's a complicated question, and it is, of course, the $64 trillion in today's money, I suppose, question. I think the answer is a standard and easy answer, and that is that whatever the dimension of the difference is and the depth of the difference is, there are two ways of looking at this. One can either try diplomacy, understanding, negotiation, cautious and from strength, or one can go to war. And those are the choices. Those are the historic choices, to talk to people or fight them. I think that for the most part, our experience post 9/11 today has a consensus behind it that says diplomacy and the resistance to knee-jerk military adventurism are the agendas that are appropriate.
Our guest is David Levering Lewis. He is university professor at New York University and his author of the newly published book, God's Crucible, Islam in the Making of Europe, 570 to 1215, published by W.W. Norton. We have other callers. We'll try to get as many as we can. Line two is next. That is Effingham. Hello.
Yes, kind of preempted my question, David, but yeah, I'll ask again. This learned man and a great repertoire of history and of humanity, can you give us any insight into the future and what we're going to become? It's just a bloody, bloody place, and the last 100 years have been the bloodiest, I think. What then is the future for humanity and social discourse and intercourse between peoples? It looks rather bleak to me.
You've kind of set me up, because I am a historian, although some people have said that perhaps I'm a little bit too speculative in my history writing. But one thing I don't do is predict the future. But I agree with you, sir, that things look very bleak. All the more reason, it seems to me, then, to pay some attention to history and tease out as best we can and as accurately as we can and as pertinently as we can some significance that will guide us. We certainly are at a fork in the road, that is, we, the American polity. November is a make-or-break moment, it seems to me, in terms of the choices before us, and they are, I think, fairly clear, although by November that clarity may have been muddied. But the choice before us is, I think, just to repeat myself, a commitment to an acknowledgement that one agenda has not worked, and indeed that it is not a solution but is part of the problem: war, neo-imperialism, and a belief that we can have unipolar decision-making that will be respected by the rest of the world. The EU is a promising development. The choices before that we have these stark choices or contradistinguishing choices is a very good thing for the American electorate. And what's happening in Latin America, it seems to me, is also significant. It may well be that as the 21st century moves along, we will have to pay much more attention to developments there, because they offer some interesting economic experiments that one needs to monitor, support, or not. And then, of course, comes China, and it may be that if the 20th century was half of it, the American century, the 21st century will be Chinese, and we will have to begin to think globally about the meanings that entail. I can't say what's going to happen, but we'd better be careful as we move towards our options.
Mm. Another caller here, Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Oh, Dr. Lewis, it's a real pleasure to talk to you. I really admire your work. Though I disagree with some of the more recent reviews about your latest book. I was going to ask you, I mean, I have a doctorate in art history, so it's less social. I mean, people don't really care what I write about, you know, paintings and wall paintings. But versus your field, which is more, you know, explanatory of historical events, and so people either to interpret it emotionally or some of them rationally, I guess. That was basically.
Well, there's some quite excitement about wallpaper, though.
I
remember Oscar Wilde, as he lay dying, I'm told, looked in that Paris hotel room, and he looked at the wallpaper and said, magenta, 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 it's time to get out of here.
I love his work, too. But I was going to ask you, I was going to ask you about how history is, you know, abused and used to explain or to manipulate the Chinese or the Russians or the Soviets, communists were supposedly good at that, the Germans were good at that, and how societies use history. Like, your books are very exploratory and informative, and then people read them, and like the person from Indiana, who I call our local Spanish Inquisition person, I understand his point of view. I mean, he's taken a side and he sticks with it, which is good. But it's interesting how history is so, it's such an emotional experience when you social history like history.
Yes. Well, I anticipated controversy. I rather welcomed it because I think controversy, informed controversy, is the meat of the social experience. But I have been surprised by some of the aspersive reactions. Really quite parochial. Several reviewers who have said, how dare you say this about my nationality, we French, us Germans.
The French. But, I mean, it's real interesting because your books touch on a subject which is really important. I mean, there are, if you've taken a college level history, you know, world history or, you know, history of mankind, you sort of pick up on little vignettes of what you talk about. But your in-depth analysis, and I really, really appreciate your work. I've read a couple of your books, and you're very, very well read and informative, and I'd like to thank you for that. But I just wanted to talk to you about how people misinterpret. It's all interpretation once you lay it out on the page, and people just – I love the responses to your book because they're just all over the place.
Oh, they are.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate your work.
Yes, my name is being spelled correctly, and I welcome the controversy. the business of using history, of course, to shape societies politically is one of the sad chapters, that recurrent chapters of the human experience, where there is only one truth, and there's no way to work around it and find the counter narrative. Or the qualifiers, and of course the Soviet experience was the dreadful example of that, and indeed the Mao's China, and it probably could be alleged that the Ahmadinejad's Iran is a sad example of that. But then we've had McCarthyism in this country, and many people worried that one of the consequences, the sure consequence of 9/11, would be a reversion to a kind of nativism and paranoia single thoughtness that we have experienced in our own American history, know-nothingism in the 19th century or McCarthyism in the immediate post-war period. So there are no immunities here. We have to constantly be vigilant to keep these core values that David Inge mentioned at the beginning. Some are good and some are deadly.
Sadly, we only have about a minute. Historians, amateur historians, love to play the what-if game. I'm not sure professional historians do as much. But what do you think, to the extent you might want to comment, what do you think might have happened if, in fact, Charles the Hammer and his troops had not managed to halt the advance into France, what is now France, in 778, and that there was a significant dramatic expansion from Iberia into the rest of Europe?
The
a number of reviewers have said, well, this is just so counterfactual that it doesn't advance the discussion. But it really wasn't counterfactual. That is, 732 was not a victory that the Muslims at all took cognizance of. It was a speed bump. It was really a skirmish as far as they were concerned. And indeed, what has not been sufficiently appreciated in the history of this is that it's 732, the Battle of Poitiers stopped nothing. They came again. The jihad, the Arabs, came again in 733. They came in 735. They came in 737. And in 740, on command from Damascus, from the Sultan, a gigantic military expedition was ready on the top of the Pyrenees for a massive invasion that would no doubtedly have prevailed. It didn't happen because there was a revolution in the Arab Empire, an overthrow of a dynasty, an end of a regime, and a relocation of the center of power, as I said earlier, from Damascus to Baghdad. It was that that spared Europe rather than Charles Martel, but of course, as Gibbon tells the story, it was Charles Martel. What would have happened? It would have meant that willy-nilly for the development of Europe commercially, technologically, philosophically, scientifically, it would have gained about three centuries, because that was about the difference in the cultural level between Islam in the 8th century and Europe, or what becomes Europe. That would have meant that Islam would have incorporated much of Europe in this dynamic ecumene. Some things would have been lost, some things would have been gained. If one believes that the one contribution of the West is individual liberty, that is uniquely something that comes from the Greeks and has been nurtured in time, then that would be something you would want to consider. If one thinks that community and solidarity and great institutional vitality are trump individual liberty, then you'd say, let's go ahead say that the jihad continuing would have been a good thing. It really doesn't matter, I think. What matters is that such a discussion enforces an appreciation of the contingency of history and the way in which these ideas of clashes of civilization and inevitability of conflicts really deserve.
We must
cold analysis.
Forgive me for interrupting. We must leave it there. Our guest, David Levering Lewis, the book is God's Crucible, published by Norton. Professor Lewis, thank you very much.
Thank you.